time for the Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cycling, and related topics. The Outspoken Cyclist is produced for broadcast and podcast, with a new show available every Saturday at 6 p.m. In Northeast Ohio, you can hear it on WJCU 88.7 FM. Catch our podcast after the close of the on-air show at OutspokenCyclist.com, iTunes, Stitcher, or PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
Hello, welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. This is our show for October 5th, 2019. Please excuse my voice this week. I have a cold, but I'm getting over it. So after some record-breaking heat this week, it appears we're finally entering the fall cycling season. I hope that crisp weather and beautiful colors will lure you outside and hopefully will convince you to not hang up your wheels too soon. I think the key to riding further into the season is definitely staying both warm and dry. To that end, there was a great article in Outside Online about dressing for the cooler weather this week. Written by the folks at Pearl Izumi, it shares a lot of great information about fabrics and layering. If you're interested in reading it, you can log on to Outside Online and find the article titled, It's Time to Rethink Your Cycling Layering System. So before we get to this week's show, I want to let you know that we will be recording at French Fender Day in Lyme, Connecticut next Saturday. Along with Peter Weigel and the crew, we'll be attempting to stream some of it live on Facebook, if I can figure that out, and then bring you the interviews in upcoming weeks. Watch our social media, Facebook and Twitter, as well as our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com, for a live feed if you're interested in seeing it firsthand. So let's get on with this week's show. Finding ways to ride longer, not only into the season, but perhaps into the seasons of your life, might fall under the first topic up for discussion today. Many years ago, Ed Benjamin hopped on the e-bike bandwagon and has never looked back. At the time, there weren't many people in his corner. But look at him today. Ed is the senior managing director of eCycle Electric Consultants, a consulting group that's focused on electric bicycle, scooter, motorcycle, and components for them since 1996. He's also the chairman of the LEVA, Light Electric Vehicle Association, which is a trade group for the industry. Today, Ed joins me to talk about the nuts and bolts of the e-bike business, how big it is, who's buying and riding the bikes, and where the future of these bikes is going. Then Tucker Schwinn, yep, you know that name, joins me to talk about a sport you may not even know existed, let alone is thriving. As far back as 1942, bicycle polo was a thing. Whether today's bike polo scene is a revival or a brand new chapter in the sport, Tucker, who has been competing since 2004, tells us all about it, how it works, who's participating, and how you can join in on the fun if you're interested. So first, it's off to Florida to speak with e-bike guru, Ed Benjamin. Hello, Ed. Welcome to the Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for being my guest this week. It's been a really long time since we caught up.
Well, hi, Diana. It's a pleasure to reconnect with you.
It is. Are you still in the south part of the country?
I live in Fort Myers, Florida.
Yeah.
Which is just about as far south as you can get.
Yeah, I remember you being in Florida back in the 80s, 90s when I was, you know, like in the bike shop world back then. And so some things change, some things don't, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, Florida's a great place to be in the bicycle business, and it's a very good place to live. I've been very fortunate. The family owned and operated bicycle shops here for a long time. It turned out to be a very good move.
Yeah. So one of the things, and the thing actually we're going to talk about today, is your belief in and working with the e-bike or electric bicycle industry. And you were, years and years ago, you were the person I knew who believed in it, and everybody sort of scoffed at it. And you have stuck with it, I guess, since 1996. Is that about right?
The industry started in 94, and I was paying attention. And in 96, I decided that I would commit to making my living as a consultant inside the electric bicycle world, which caused my wife to cry and complain that she said she didn't want to be poor all of her life. And it caused several people in the normal bicycle industry to call me up and say, well, you've taken yourself out of, you're no longer a competition for us. Thank you. And then I had other people call me up and say, you know, it's going to be many, many years before you can make that work. Turns out they were wrong.
So if we look at the e-bike, electric assist bikes today, how are they different from when you first started and first had this belief that they would become a thing? And now they're a big thing.
And that's a really insightful question. The e-bikes of 94, 95, 96, if you bought one, you had to be pretty handy and pretty clever and pretty determined to get it to work and keep it working. And that was, unfortunately, the experience a lot of dealers had in the late 90s, where they would buy e-bikes, even from famous companies like Trek and Giant, and they would be a frustrating service issue. So e-bikes became consistently reliable about 2005. Before that, the business grew crazy fast in Asia. It grew quickly, but not as crazy fast in Europe. And in the United States, it was very slow growth. But starting about 2005, 2006, the European sales curve started to look like the proverbial hockey stick, where sales were doubling every year. And again, the United States it was still pretty quiet. But then approximately 2010, we were introduced to the idea of an electric mountain bike. Now, one of the things that we have going on in Asia is an electric bicycle is transportation. It's transportation it's affordable. It means I can get to work or I can get to the metro station without being sweaty. I can live farther away from the metro station or farther away from work, which means I can have a less expensive or nicer home. There was a no-brainer. People bought them. They bought tens, actually now hundreds of millions of them. In Europe, bicycles were always transportation. And yeah, we have bicycle sport, but bicycles in Europe were transportation. In the United States, bicycles are sport, fitness, and recreation. The transportation aspect of bicycles is a minor one in the American cultural paradigm. So when electric mountain bikes came along, suddenly electric bicycles fit into the American concept of what a bicycle should be. And people, particularly people my age, I'm retiree aged, although I won't retire. I got too much to do. But the people my age, the baby boomers, who had always enjoyed riding in their mountain bikes and always enjoyed riding their bicycles outdoors, discovered that an electric bike, in the words of one guy, is a 15-year extension of my season. And riding an electric mountain bike in the mountains, I'm old, I'm fat, I can still ride an electric mountain bike in the mountains. I cannot ride a normal mountain bike in the mountains. So that's a huge benefit. And it was a benefit that was directly benefited the people who had been spending the most money. The baby boomers have spent more money on bicycles than any other demographic group in the history of the human race. So all of a sudden, American industry, American bicycle industry, and American consumer and American dealers became very interested in electric bicycles. And we've had from around 2012 to about 2016, we had roughly the sales were doubling every year. Then in 2016-17, we got into some political chaos. And right now we've got some steep tariffs that are acting as a brake on the industry. But the industry is still growing and people are still buying. How's that for a tiring monologue to listen to?
Oh, it was excellent. Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Ed Benjamin. He is the Senior Managing Director of eCycle Electric Consultants and the Chairman of the Light Electric Vehicle Association. It's a trade group for the e-bike industry. So now we know what your role kind of is. What is LEVA, the Light Electric Vehicle Association? What exactly is it mandated to do?
Well, our statement says that we promote the industry and the use of electric power, light electric vehicles, which is mostly electric bicycles, although we have members that are into human transporters and electric motorcycles and electric mopeds. But the bulk of the business is electric bicycles. So LEVA mission statement is very simple. We're here to promote the industry. Almost all of our activity has been supply side. We, in the United States, leave trains technicians to work on electric bikes at the bicycle shop level. We operate networking, and this networking is very important. A lot of people are getting into or have gotten into electric bicycle business. It's a new business to them. They need to make friends. They need to learn what's a good idea and what's a bad idea. They need to find suppliers or they need to find customers. So LEVA, I heard somebody say one time that LEVA was a club for people in the electric bicycle business. And that's not a bad way to look at it. We used to joke that if you came to three of our networking dinners, you were now an industry insider. And that's actually kind of true.
Huh.
You would have met probably 300 people. You'd have business cards from about 300 people. And if you're going, well, where do I buy that? You probably know the answer to it. LEVA's training of bicycle mechanics. We cooperate with Barnett Bicycle Institute. We operate a two-day seminar in Fort Myers, Florida, and in Danville, Virginia. We have online education that we offer for levels 1, 2, 3, and 4 technician training. We also have a cooperation program in Puerto Rico and one in India. I'm not sure what our total number of technicians that we've had contact with, but it's got to be something like 1,200 or more. And that was one of our early goals, was to take away the fear. The service guys would say, I don't know how to work on these. I'm afraid that I'm going to do something wrong. I'm afraid I don't know how to fix these. So we have spent about 8 years helping the bicycle mechanics of America learn how to fix electric bikes and to try to take away that fear. Now, we have another arm, LEVA EU, and people often get a little bit puzzled. LEVA USA and LEVA EU are actually two different organizations that cooperate very closely. LEVA EU is involved in market statistics, market study, and representing the interests, I'd like to say, representing the interests of importers and retailers to the European Union legislative regulatory process. So the boss of Europe, of LEVA EU, Anik Rutink. Anik lives in Brussels, and she is expert on the legal and regulatory and legislative issues of Europe. LEVA United States does not involve ourselves in regulatory or political issues because People for Bikes is doing a great job, and we would never be able to improve on it.
Hmm. Interesting. So that brings me to a couple of questions. Actually, I have a whole bunch, but how big is the U.S. e-bike market and how sophisticated? Well, let's start with that. How big is the e-bike market in the U.S.? How many bikes are we? First of all, how is it measured? Because, of course, this is the ongoing thing. Are we measuring units or dollars? You know, it's always the same old thing in the bike business. But how do you measure the bike market here in the U.S.?
I measure it by, since almost every electric bike is manufactured overseas, the ones that we use in the United States, they all come from overseas. So I look at imports.
Ah, very good.
And imports are not a cut and dried thing. Only recently have we had a uniform number to describe electric bikes in the importing process. So I have often been playing detective where I try to I'll cross-reference descriptions and addresses and known buyers and known suppliers. And we come up with what we think is a pretty close number. There are other people who study the units quantity, and those folks, their basic methodology is to get retailers to report to them their point of sale information. That point of sale information comes from some of the better bicycle shops. One of the things about the electric bicycle world is it is not distributed only through bicycle shops. In fact, the bulk of electric bicycles are distributed through channels other than bike shops. So if you're just studying bicycle shops, you only see part of the picture. So how many bikes? Right now, I estimate that since the Trump tariffs went into effect the last 2-3 years, the sales have been in the vicinity of 250,000-270,000 units per year, and that in 2019, it's going to climb to about 300,000 units. My guess is, and it's just a guess, that if we didn't have these tariffs, the sales would be twice that or greater. But one of the important things I like to point out to people is people say, well, the United States buys something that is sending 15 million bicycles every year. That's not an exact number, but it's in that general neighborhood. But most of those 15 million bicycles are $40, $50, $60 items. in the electric bicycle world, the lowest price electric bike you're going to find is $650, and probably the average is somewhere above 1,000. And some of them are into the 3,000, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000, 7,000 range. So the dollars that are being handled by the electric bike industry are dramatically greater than the numbers would suggest when looked at as a component of the normal bicycle business.
Interesting. We're going to take a real quick break, and when we come back, we're going to speak some more with Ed Benjamin about the e-bike industry. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
WJCU, University Heights, from the campus of John Carroll University.
We are back. If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Ed Benjamin. Ed and I have actually known each other a long time, and he's been with the e-bike world for as long as I can remember. Certainly one of the very first early adopters of the whole concept of electric assist and electric vehicles. So he is also the senior managing director of eCycle Electric Consultants and the chairman of the LEVA, Light Electric Vehicle Association. So we kind of left off with numbers. Tell me about the complexity of an e-bike. I know you do training for mechanics, and that's a really important thing. But how does it dovetail with the traditional bicycle shop and whether or not they, I know there are other outlets for e-bikes and electric assist. How is it, I mean, so if somebody opens a bike shop and they want to carry electric bikes, do you ask for their mechanic to come someplace and learn? How do you train them to work on these bikes? We have a whole different mechanical kind of world with an e-bike.
Yeah, well, one of the things that I always enjoy pointing out is that it is a lot more complicated to take care of the mechanical issues of a bicycle than it is to take care of the electrical components. And that's often a surprise for our mechanic. Most of the problems of an electric bike are bicycle problems: flat tires, broken spokes, brakes need to be adjusted. And this goes a long ways towards helping bike mechanics realize that this is not a product they need to be afraid of. The most basic approach to fixing an e-bike is extremely simple. You figure out which component is not working and you replace it. And we get into, here's how you handle these kind of connectors, and this is how you do soldering, and this is how you use these the voltmeter so you can detect the component that's not working. But at the end of the day, it is the mechanical stuff requires years of experience. The electronic stuff I can teach you in 2 days, and most people are very surprised. Now, it used to be we were the only people offering training. In the last 2-3 years, the various systems makers, for example, Bosch, offer clinics, and I think Bosch has been doing it for longer than that. But today, in the last 2-3 years, almost every systems maker is offering some kind of training specific to their equipment. It's an automotive, and a lot of these guys have got an automotive concept where you basically plug a computer into the device and ask it what's wrong with it. It tells you what part needs to be replaced. You replace that part, and that's not difficult to do. So that's It may be a very quick view of what's going on with the training of mechanics or technicians, as we like to call them.
Do you deal with bike shops yourself, or do you sort of deal in the after purchase part of the transaction where a bike shop will go to a manufacturer, buy a line of e-bikes, and then you are the next sort of tier of information to get that e-bike out on the road and get mechanics done?
Or yeah. Okay. That's a good way to see. You know Barnett Bicycle Institute,
oh,
I'm
of
sure.
Course.
Just imagine that we were a very small and very mobile, but have roughly the same kind of business model. We're not affiliated with any manufacturer. We are sponsored or supported in terms of giving us free parts and giving us information by several companies. But we're not beholden to anybody. We're not dedicated to anybody. And that's one of our virtues. If you go to a seminar put on by a motor maker that just makes this system, you're going to learn how to take care of that system. And that's great. But what about all the other stuff that's out there? And what we teach are the fundamentals that allow you to diagnose just about anything. You may not walk out of there able to solve a problem on the e-bike in 5 minutes, but you will walk out of there with the information that you need to solve the problem. And after you've done it once or twice, it may only take you 5 minutes. So we teach the basics, the fundamentals.
So how sophisticated are e-bikes today?
There's a range. But one of the things that is a reality is that any e-bike is a very complex machine. It's got all the mechanical attributes of a bicycle. And then it's got an electric motor, and it's got a sophisticated battery, and it's got a sophisticated battery management system, and it's got a motor controller, and then there's some kind of control paradigm, a torque sensor or a throttle. And all that adds up to quite a lot of system complexity. But there's quite a difference. If you buy a $650 e-bike off of Amazon, you get a bike that we regard as very simple. The performance on it might be functional for you, but probably not very exciting. And the systems that are on it have limited range of features. They're actually quite easy to fix, which is nice. And then you keep stepping up. You know, you go to an e-bike. Evelo is a good example. They use systems that are not proprietary, but are very good. And their pricing is, I think they start at $1,500, $1,600, $1,700, and they go up into the thousands. And then you've got the major bike brands like Trek and Specialized, where you have a significant change in complexity or significant change in sophistication. The systems, the expensive bicycle brand bikes tend to use mid-drive systems that come from automotive suppliers. And those automotive suppliers are very much focused on software, information features, self-diagnosing features, telematics. And now we get into some vehicles that are as sophisticated as that Lexus automobile. I guess the answer to your question is there's a very wide range, and the most sophisticated bikes are very sophisticated.
Let me remind our listeners once again, we're speaking with Ed Benjamin. We are speaking about e-bikes and some of the nuts and bolts of the e-bike business. But I want to kind of shift the conversation a little bit to talk about who's buying them and what the demand is, what you think the demand in the future will be. And then I want to talk a little bit about the legislative issues. So who is buying the e-bike today? Who is your core customer?
Well, one of the things I like to say when people ask questions like that is I like to point out that about 260, 270 million people rode an e-bike to work today. And that is worldwide. And yeah, it's a big number. There's more people rode an e-bike to work today than Americans that drove a car to work today. The bulk of them are in China, with a lot of them in other places like Vietnam. And we have about 10 million electric bikes that are extant in Europe, and we have something close to 2 million of them that have been sold in the United States and are probably still serviceable. So the numbers are, in one hand, quite surprising as far as who's buying them. We have some groups that I really enjoy learning about. One of them is what I call the normal bike shop guys. They were the people that bought $5,000 carbon bikes. They're the people who have been buying a new bicycle every year since 1975. They're now old enough that they're discovering that the electric bike allows them to keep up with the younger guys, or even to leave the younger guys behind. That's more fun.
Yeah, true.
And so for them, it's a season extender. They've always been a customer of Trek Specialized or somebody. So for them, to show them a really nice, sophisticated, major brand name electric bike is just kind of an automatic good idea. This group is spending big money, but it's not a very large group. I don't actually have a number for it, but it's not a huge number of people. And then we have the group that I think of as millennials who cannot afford a car or don't want to afford a car. They live in San Francisco, Boston, downtown New York, etc. Owning a car is a pain in the ass. They can't park it. They don't want to pay for the insurance. Their income is not as good as they would like for it to be. So, but they got to get to the metro station or the bus station or to work, and they don't want to be all sweaty when they get there. Some of these young people are buying normal bicycles and pedaling to work. But a lot of these young people are buying electric bicycles because it's less effort, it's faster, and it doesn't cost that much. You know, the difference in price between a $1,500 commuter electric bike and a $16,000 a basic automobile or basic sedan, that's a pretty loud argument. And if it costs you $800 a month to park it, that's also important.
Yeah.
And so then there's insurance. So in any case, that group, the millennials, they have a transportation focus, but they're also enjoying their bikes. And then we have another important group, which I think of as the old fat baby boomers. These are not the people that bought $5,000 road bikes. These are the people that like to sit on their bike, ride it around in their neighborhood. They may spend half of the trip sitting on their bike, telling their neighbors what a wonderful bike they bought, or just socializing. And there's a company called Pedego that has done a brilliant job of introducing product that this group likes and to market it in such a way and have the appropriate, I call it building a community. You know, most bicycle shops, if they're building a community, historically they've built a competition community. They don't build a community of people who go out and ride in the evening for 45 minutes and are more social than athletic. Pedego saw that, got it, offered them a product that they like. And at the moment, I think Pedego is probably selling more bikes than anybody else in the United States in unit volume. So, you know, hats off to them. They saw that the baby boomers would like a nice, comfortable cruiser, and they provided it. Another group, much smaller but still a significant group, is the folks who cannot afford a car, don't want to afford a car because of their documentation, their financials, whatever their issue might be. In my mind, these are the folks that are parking their electric bike behind the restaurant, behind the hospital. These are modestly paid service workers, oftentimes immigrants, sometimes illegal immigrants who don't want to go through the exposure of trying to get a driver's license or being found driving a car. And what they're finding is they don't have much money. They're not the millennials are much better off than they are. But the inexpensive electric bike allows them to get back and forth to work without being sweaty, without being as tired. And I used to do what I call, or used to suggest that people do, the backdoor survey. Drive past the back door of places that employ a large number of low-paid service workers, and you will see today, you're almost certain to see a little cluster of electric bikes and normal bikes. And then finally, we've got the DUIs. There are many states where the only motor vehicle that you can operate if you have a DUI is an electric bike. That doesn't sound like a wonderful, important niche. And it's not as big as the other niches. But if we were to count up all the DUIs in America, I think it would be a rather startling number. So that's kind of a quick tour of our markets.
Wow.
Baby boomers, number one, millennials, number two. And then there's some subdivisions of those.
Right, right. Wow. So interesting. So where do you think, and we started talking about this before we actually decided to turn this into the conversation we're having now. You and I were chatting ahead of time about the bike shop and where the bike shop isn't often nimble, flexible, or seeing the future. Clearly, e-bikes are here to stay. That recently, right here in Northeast Ohio, the National Park Service announced that e-bikes are allowed on all national park lands. So clearly they're being accepted. Legislation has been coming down in favor of e-bikes. The bike shop seems to me a logical place to go and get an e-bike, and yet I know a lot of them aren't getting involved. What's the problem?
Well, let's think about the guy that owns a bike shop. He's usually a guy. I know that you have had a tremendous involvement in women cycling business, but the average owner of a bike shop and the average person that works in a bike shop is usually male, and they're usually got into it because they love cycling, and that means they've got big quadriceps, and they literally don't understand and have a terrible time grasping the idea that there are people out there that are not strong, that don't want to sweat, that don't have big quadriceps, and the electric motor is just fine with that group. One of the comments I've had as I pursued this business is people saying, well, that's cheating. I'm like, cheating? Explain to me, cheating at what? I'm cheating at being comfortable? When I was a young guy, I was a bicycle racer, and I was later a triathlete and a runner. I get it. But most Americans don't have that background. Most Americans regard an accelerated heart rate and sweat coming out of their pores as an undesirable thing. So the bicycle industry, populated mostly by former BMXers, former mountain bike racers, former road bike racers, or people who had some, that was how they got into this. Maybe they were even long-range tourists. They're like the last people in the world to understand the baby boomer who wants to ride casually and comfortably around the neighborhood and spends most of his time sitting on the seat and chatting with his neighbors. It's a different cultural group. So there was one time I was reading a definition of a phrase, outside context problem, meaning your life experiences do not prepare you to understand this. And I think that's the problem the bicycle shops of America have with electric bikes. It's outside their context. They don't get it. Now, they do get making money or not making money. And it used to be, back in 2005, 2006, I was driving around in Southern California with a big truck. I'd pull into a parking lot of a bicycle shop. I'd get a couple electric bikes out. I'd put them on the ground. I'd push one through the front door of the bike shop. And 50% of the time, somebody in the bike shop would say, get that junk out of here. That has changed. Today, the bicycle shop owners of America have figured out that electric bikes are a large margin. They're a large ticket. They're relatively easy to sell. They're as reliable as normal bikes. And they make money. And this is a little bit reminiscent of what happened in Europe. In Europe, in 2004, there was an article run in a trade journal there where they interviewed a store owner in Holland. And if you think Americans are bigoted about muscle-powered bikes, you ought to go to Holland. These people are strong cyclists, rode their bike every day of their life. If they have to use an electric bike, it must be that they're old. They don't want to be perceived as old. And so the Dutch were in the 90s were resistant to the idea of electric bikes. And then in 2004, there was a magazine article where the interviewer interviewed the owner of a Dutch bicycle shop, and he said the Dutch bicycle shop owner said, "When I sell a normal bicycle, I make 50 euros profit. When I sell an electric bicycle, I make 1,000 euros profit. You see that Mercedes out there in the front door? That was bought with electric bicycle money." Well, it took about 6 weeks for most of the bike shops in Northern Europe to put an electric bike in their window. I'm exaggerating slightly, but something very similar to that happened in America over the last 2 years. If you go to a bicycle anything today, the conversation is about electric bikes. I just got back from Eurobike, and at Eurobike, for several years now, we've jokingly called Eurobike Electrobike. And this time I walked around with a notepad trying to find companies that do not offer an electric bike as part of their line. Out of the hundreds of booths that offer a bicycle line or a bicycle model, I think I found five that were purists, so to speak. Everybody else had some kind of electric bike in their line. This is real simple. That's what's making money. So for the bicycle industry, there's nothing louder than that makes money. For the American bicycle industry, we've woken up to the fact that electric bikes make money, and they're very, very suitable for our American customer who is not in great shape, does enjoy going outside, does enjoy being out of doors, has always enjoyed cycling, and by the way, he's getting old. So,
and by the way, he's getting what? That got killed. Say it again.
He's getting old.
Oh, no, we're not getting old. Maybe a little. Wow. Such an interesting perspective, and one that seems just spot on, really spot on. Well, if listeners were interested in learning, because there is a huge sort of variety and range of electric bikes, if listeners are interested in learning about e-bikes in general, is there a place they can go and get some comparisons of, you know, XYZ company compared to ABC company and some of the reviews? Is there something like a bicycling magazine that reviews new bikes every year for e-bike?
Well, yes, to all of those. Today, online dominates this kind of information. So electricbikereports.com and electricbikereviews.com, run by Pete Priebus, and one's run by Court. What's Court's last name? It'll come to me in a moment. Both of them great guys. Both of them do a really good job. Pete's is an engineer by background. Court might be more sociable, but they tend to test ride bikes, videotape the bikes, publish a lot of information about them. I regard them as excellent resources. There's a paper magazine, a print magazine out that's done by the same people that did Mountain Bike Action, and I think it might be called Electric Bike Action. Done, I believe Zap Espinoza is the editor, although that may have changed. And of course, you'll be familiar with his name. The issues I've seen have been glossy. Hey, isn't this an exciting kind of product? So it's not a bad place to start. But there's such an enormous amount of product out there now that Electric Bike Reports, Electric Bike Reviews probably are better resources.
Well, unfortunately, we have to wrap it. But I've been speaking with Ed Benjamin about the electric bike market. I still have probably a gazillion more questions, so I'm reserving the right to call you again and we'll have another conversation. Ed is the Senior Managing Director of eCycle Electric Consultants. He is the chairman of the Light Electric Vehicle Association. It's a trade group for the e-bike industry. Thank you so much for talking with me today. It's been a fascinating conversation. We'll get more information at another time. How's that?
Well, thanks for the opportunity, Diane. It was really delightful to talk to you, and I hope that my monologues here have been of some use to your listeners.
I'm sure they will enjoy it. I certainly did. We'll talk again. Thanks, Ed.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Ed Benjamin is the Senior Managing Director of eCycle Electric Consultants, a consulting group focused on electric bicycle, scooter, motorcycle, and components for them since 1996. He's also the chairman of the Light Electric Vehicle Association, a trade group for the industry. If you're interested in LEVA, you can log on to levaassociation.com. So we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we'll learn all about bicycle polo with Tucker Schwinn. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist.
You're listening to the station that is your home for college radio in Cleveland, 88.7 FM, WJCU, University Heights.
Back. I'm Diane Jenks, and you're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We've all heard about road, track, cross, gravel, and crit racing. Bicycling as competition has probably been around since, well, the first two bicycles were on the same street. The sport of bicycle polo, however, is a bit more obscure, but it seems to be no less intriguing and perhaps might just be the next big thing. Here's my conversation with Tucker Schwinn to learn all about it. Hi, Tucker. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
It is my pleasure. We've known each other a long time, and I keep forgetting that you are a bicycle polo player and understand that sport within our industry probably as well, if not better, than anybody. So I'm wondering first how you got into bike polo. What was it that attracted you to it?
I got into polo in around 2005. I was 18 years old. I was a BMX rider throughout my teenage years. I was getting into the fixed gear craze. This is about 2005. And one day I was working at a bicycle co-op with this guy named Jason. I don't know him anymore, but he invited me out to this sport called bike polo. And as soon as I showed up, it was, you know, a group of people on bicycles hitting a ball around. I'd never seen it before. And I scored a goal my first day, and it kind of just got me hooked. It was cool. I remember it very vividly.
Yeah, I'll bet you do, especially that beginner's luck of a first-time goal. That's pretty cool. So I assume it has some real rules and regulations. I did kind of look up polo. I don't know if you remember a guy named Richard Olkin. He owned a bike shop back in the day in Boston. But he sent me a picture of a cover of a polo, sort of bike polo regulations thing from 1942. So I know it's been around a long time. I know. Isn't that cool? But he didn't show me the book, just the cover. So how is the game played?
First off, let's create a little bit of a distinction. There's a traditional form of bike polo that was played in, whenever you see bike polo, you'll see a reference to an Olympics in the 1890s. And that is more of an equestrian style polo that looks a lot like horse polo and is still very much played around the world. The version of bike polo I play is called hardcourt bike polo. It's been around since about 2000, give or take a year. So what makes hardcourt very interesting, or at least as far as rules are concerned, there's two basic ones. One is you need to stay on your bike. If you put your foot down, you need to tap in at a center line. First and foremost, there are two goals per side. There are three people per team, and you want to score 5 points or the most amount of points within a certain period of time. There's also a rule that's very subtle to outsiders, but it's very important within the sport, which is when you score or when you shoot the ball, you need to hit it off the end of the head, which it looks like if you're staring at like a drinking glass, it would be like the cylindrical circle end. And that counts as a shot. If you hit it broadside or just kind of like smack the ball sideways, that's known as a shuffle. Which is not considered a shot. However, it is considered a legal pass. Other rules include, contact is you can't T-bone someone. You can't just run into them to knock them off their bike. You can't do a floor check or something that can intentionally really hurt someone. And then there's a rule that's kind of be kind. Show some etiquette around the court as far as being polite, don't intentionally hurt someone. It's already a sport with an inherent amount of danger. To add a physical element to it, or I should say someone doing something intentional is very frowned upon. So very simple rules. At the competitive level, once you start going into tournaments, those rules get very complex. Over the years, people have managed to dissect and reinterpret those rules just like any other sport. So there is actually a group of people that will manage those rules and update them every year if needed. But for just pick up, simple, it's like five rules.
Let me remind our listeners, we're speaking with Tucker Schwimm. We're talking about bicycle polo. So we always talk about road racing and track racing and cross and gravel. And here's another whole sport within our sport. So who's playing bicycle polo? How do you find a group of people? And is it mainly men? I mean, do you care if there are women on the team? Or is it a mixed gender sport?
That's actually a really great question. It is a mixed gender sport. If you look at the demographics, you'll see that it is predominantly men. Historically has been predominantly men. However, there has been a huge push within the sport since the beginning for it to be a co-ed sport. For a long time, it was just mainly in name, but within the past 4 years, it's been heavily practiced to where there are, at least in a tournament sense, there are teams that have women on them. From a pickup and club standpoint, the participation of WTF players, women trans femme, have been growing substantially and very positively to the point where some clubs are holding WTF nights to create a comfortable learning environment for bike polo, and it's being ran by women. It's being, sometimes up into the numbers of 20 players coming in exploring polo or just playing in an atmosphere that's comfortable. At the competitive level, there's been pushes within the past couple of years to be more inclusive. So there's a ton of women that play and it's growing all the time. And honestly, it kind of, is a huge part of our culture in hardcore bike polo.
Nice.
So yeah, there's not many sports that have men and women competing together just like as a basic component of the culture.
Right. On a level playing field, you know, so that if you're a bicycle, then that's one of the questions I have about handling skills. So how important is it to be able to handle your, I mean, you're not only riding your bike, you're also, you know, wielding a mallet here, or if that's what you call it. I don't know what you call it in polo. I guess that is sort of, and whacking a ball around. What?
Yeah. I mean, we call it a mallet. It is a challenge. It's not an easy sport. For some, it looks a little intimidating if they're not familiar with cycling. But one of the things I really like to stress to people is, like, if you're already a cyclist, and let's say you're just riding from the coffee shop a short distance, and you're holding a cup of coffee, and you're bouncing, and you're going, you know, in a straight line, or even turning around the corner, that's sort of a fundamental skill for bike polo, just being able to ride one-handed. Everything else kind of comes with practice. It is a little weird. Almost everyone I know that plays it the first time, doesn't matter their skill level, complete novice or, you know, Cat 3, Cat 2 racer, everyone agrees that first time is just, it's really weird. It's really hard. But if you get fit, you end up sticking with it, and it's totally something you could pick up basic skill set within a couple weeks of playing.
Do you have to have a special bike, or are there special, like, brakes, gears? Do you use clipless pedals? What kinds of equipment?
For sure. There are polo-specific bikes, and there has been for going on a decade. We'll go into the fundamentals first of what makes a polo bike. Single speed, a brake, front or rear. Generally, you want to have a gear ratio that allows you to accelerate. It's not a sport that requires a top speed. It requires acceleration. So where, you know, someone with a six gear bike might be running like a 46-16 gear ratio, for those of you that are familiar, a bike polo bike will be between 30 teeth up front, 20 teeth in the rear, or I think the highest someone will ride will essentially be 36 to 22. Which is a very light ratio, something you would use for climbing. In polo, it's used for going 20 feet really fast. And as far as the polo-specific bikes, they will have narrow wheelbases, usually under 1,000 millimeters. They will have, you know, a mix between wheel sizes, like you have 700C bikes, track bikes, very popular size, a 26-inch bike, which gives you a very narrow wheelbase, and it's been adopted by the community. And you're starting to see some 650 bikes because of the practicality of that size and also the growing availability of those parts. A lot of players at the highest level will ride clipped in. This is because the sport has evolved to have some level of jumping around. Jumping around on flats is very difficult, especially with one hand to the handlebars. So players over time have adapted to clipless pedals so that they can maneuver the bike, sometimes even jumping in a 180 to get into the correct position. As far as brakes are concerned, a lot of the competitive level are riding front brake only. This is because that's where a lot of your stopping power is, but it also enables you to do like an endo pivot.
Right.
So people are changing position on their front wheel by using that brake.
Wow.
It's kind of a funny bike. I mean, you'll see a pack of polo players in your local city riding together, and all these bikes look really mean, but they're going incredibly slow because it's not really a great street ride.
Let me remind our listeners again, we're speaking with Tucker Schwimm. We're speaking about bicycle polo, a sport maybe you didn't really know was out there, but a sport that sounds like it's a lot of fun. So, Tucker, how's the average age? I mean, I have to be honest and say a lot of the listeners to the show are in their 50s, mm-hmm. 60s, 70s. This sounds sort of like a young person's sport, but you're in your 30s now and you're doing it. And I know there are BMX racers in their 30s still racing. So is this sort of an all-come sport as far as age goes?
I'd say so, at least at the community and pickup level. If you show up to your local court with all your gear and you're ready to play, you'd be very hard-pressed to have anyone turn you down for some court time. At the competitive level, you're probably looking at a lot of players in their early 30s, late 20s. The rare players might be in their late teens. We're still kind of a, I don't know what you'd want to call it, like a post-teenage, teenager sport.
Young adult.
Correct. Yeah, there are players in their 60s, though, in both New York and Washington, D.C. There are some older players that have just been around. And I'll say this much, over time, the rules have changed to make that more of a friendly sport. It used to be very contact-driven, so it used to be very easy to get hurt. Now, those contact rules have become more strict. So it's actually, you know, it's a much easier game to play. It's not a game ruled by, you know, thugs and, you know, big buff people. It's a game that requires more finesse, more vision, and more skill. So, you know, that people from various ages can achieve all of those things. So I'd say it's, you know, it is like a millennial sport, but it's really welcome to anyone that's got the patience and time for it.
Is there a governing body?
Yes. In the United States, or I should say in North America, so United States, Mexico, and Canada, we have the NAH, North American Hard Court. Currently is ran by Jennifer Spencer, who was elected last year as president. And we're probably on our, I think, fourth president at this point. And it's been an organization that's been active since 2009. So they're responsible for organizing or just coordinating tournaments for like regional qualifiers for a national or a North American qualifier that then goes to the world. The heads of those groups will work with members of the European Hard Court League and the Asian Hard Court League, Australian and South American, and they'll all collaborate to work on a rule set that's amicable for all regions. And that's who runs the show here in the United States. They'll coordinate those tournaments, help guide everyone that's running the tournament as far as like running the bracketing software, ensure there's like refs are being facilitated for courts. And yeah, they really help run the show. It's like herding cats, so I give them credit. really, like it's a lot of people that are working incredibly hard for a sport that's virtually unknown. So I am always appreciative of them.
No kidding. Yeah, it sounds like a lot of fun. So, if you were to take a guess at the number of riders who are actually participating in bicycle polo in the U.S., do you have any idea of what kind of numbers we're talking about?
I mean, it's, you know, there's the people I see on the internet and then there's the people that kind of surprise me out of the woodwork. I mean, I would say we're looking at maybe 1,000 players nationwide. And when you roll up to a tournament, you're probably, you know, you're going to see 100 people.
Uh-huh.
But what I found over the years is there's a lot of people that just don't participate in those tournaments. And so they are out of the periphery, but they still are very active. So, you know, over 1,000 makes a lot of sense to me. And as it's, as time goes on and we're growing, you're starting to see clubs kind of, you know, pop up in the middle of nowhere and, they're extremely active. So I'd say about 1,000 in the country here, worldwide. You know, 1,500, 2,000. I'd like to think a lot more, though.
Sure, sure. Well, so is there a way to find out about the sport online? Is there a website that they could go to?
Yeah, I would Google or look up North American Hard Court Bike Polo. That's where you can find news, the rule set, different tidbits of information, even finding an active club in your area. It'll even tell you what region you are in. For instance, I'm in Milwaukee. I play in the Great Lakes region. You can simply look up your state or look at your state on a map and then see what region. Generally, there'll be a short list of available cities to play in. That being said, had I mentioned before, there are clubs sort of popping up all over the place. I would advise even just Googling your state or your city and bike polo. We're starting to see clubs pop up in like Boise, Idaho, that wasn't around 4 or 5 years ago. We're starting to see clubs like Central Wisconsin. So it's active. It's very likely you can find someone in your area. If not, people will probably be enthusiastic in helping you start a club.
It just sounds fascinating. And there's probably video online of what bicycle polo looks like, I would imagine, on YouTube or something.
Oh, there most certainly is. If you, YouTube and Vimeo are both great places. Yeah, I did say that right. The polo community just had a Worlds in Cordoba, Argentina. And so that stuff is available online as well. Yeah, YouTube is a great source. There have been people active in recording tournaments since probably 2008, and the quality has only gotten better over time. So, you know, YouTube is kind of like a great archive for this stuff because it can show you what polo looked like, you know, in 2008, and it'll show you what it looked like in 2019.
Well, Tucker, thank you so much for enlightening us about bicycle polo. We've been talking with Tucker Schwinn. He is a bike polo player and has been for, wow, it sounds like almost 15 years, huh?
Yeah, we're moving on our 15th year. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I appreciate you talking with me. We will look into bicycle polo. Thanks so much. Have a great afternoon.
Yeah, you as well. Thank you for having me on the show.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
As Tucker suggested, if you're interested in bicycle polo, you can log on to nahardcourt.com, where you can find out about clubs, tournaments, and rules. So that's our show for this week. I hope you enjoyed the conversations with Ed Benjamin and Tucker Schwinn. My thanks to both of them. Remember to check our Facebook page and Twitter feed next Saturday afternoon when we will be broadcasting live from French Fender Day in Lyme, Connecticut. Along with Peter Weigel and, of course, Brian, there will be a host of other great guests ooing and aahing over the classic French Fender bikes that will be on display. Remember that you can always join the conversation on our Facebook page. You can send us a tweet at Outspoken Cyclist without the E. You can leave a comment on any show on our blog, OutspokenCyclist.com. Won't you please consider subscribing to our podcast on your favorite app, whether it be Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Google, PRX, or any of the other apps that might be on your phone. Then leave us a great review. Well, please leave us a great review, won't you? Thank you for listening. Have a great week. Stay safe out there. And remember, if you have a chance, go for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We hope you enjoyed this week's show and welcome your comments and thoughts on Twitter and Facebook. Visit OutspokenCyclist.com to hear this and all past shows. We'll be back next week with more great conversation and news from the world of cycling. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or Stitcher and never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.